This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
Our guest today is Dr. Mark Allman. Mark is a lecturer in history at Oriel College at Oxford. This academic year, he's a visiting professor in Turkey. He's a very prolific writer, I think, particularly of the many articles that he's done for the International Herald Tribune, very prescient articles about what was going on in Georgia. He's an expert not only in Georgia, but in all the former republics of the Soviet Union, where the United States and Russia have been battling it out since the end of the Cold War. Mark, talk to us today about the true story about what's been going on in Georgia and some of the activities, say, of the very important left neoconservative George Soros. Talk to us about what the future holds and what the effects of American foreign policy, very aggressive foreign policy, in these areas of the former Soviet Union.
It's an unfortunate story in many ways that really since 1991, the West, with obviously the United States as by far the most important country, has pursued policies which I think are now rather backfired very publicly, but really have been problematic for a long time. Under the guise of promoting democracy and the free market, in fact, we've tended to be choosing local clients and very often creating kind of client economies. There's a lot of myth that, particularly at the time of the crisis, this August between Russia and Georgia was in much of our media, that Georgia was a plucky model democracy, that it had a vibrant market economy, and it was being suppressed by the wicked sort of Russian bear that very much was having nostalgia for the old Soviet communist system. We leave aside Russia for the moment, which is a big subject in its own right. The problem is really that Georgia has a kind of clientistic economic system, not at all like a free market system. Its budget, the state budget, has been heavily dependent on Western donations of aid from the United States, from the European Union countries. And so far from being a vibrant economy, as some of the official statistics suggest, in fact, it's very much dependent upon getting cash out of the Western taxpayer. And that is really for geopolitical reasons, whereby Georgia and countries like Georgia are seen as being useful bulwarks to keep Russia in its place, to expand NATO, and so on. And that may be true geopolitically, but it has meant that we've rather been sold, if you like, a puff about just how democratic or how free market, how liberal, in the old-fashioned classical sense, Georgia is. I've been going there since 1992, and you see, in a sense, the same syndrome coming around, that people will remember that for years, Edward Shevardnadze's regime was presented as a model regime. He was our friend. He'd helped bring the Cold War to the end. People ignored the human rights problems in Georgia under his regime, terrible torture, terrible conditions in prisons, the repression of the opposition, fraud in elections, until suddenly 2003 comes along and the previous supporters of Shevardnadze turn against him. James Baker had given him the Enron prize for public service only a few years earlier, suddenly comes and says, now your time's up, you've got to make way for a new thrusting young President Mikhail Saakashvili. George Soros had backed Shevardnadze, suddenly his money and his so-called NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, are getting money to get rid of Shevardnadze and bring in Saakashvili. The problem is, although Saakashvili came in on a ticket of youthful change, to use a contemporary slogan, in practice, he simply was a younger version of Shevardnadze. He was getting support from the same sources in the West, in the States, running very much a clientistic regime of his own, just as Shevardnadze's family did well out of the support from the West. So Saakashvili's family are very much the dominant figures in the economy and in particularly government procurement. Because coming back to the NATO question, if you want to join NATO, you have to have a NATO-style army and Air Force, NATO weaponry and weapon systems. And you can only get those from a few Western countries. And so we have a peculiar, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back system, whereby the US, British, Israelis, for instance, give money to the Georgian government to buy technology, to buy training and equipment from their own companies. And so 70% of the Georgian state budget was spent on the military. So certainly it wasn't a welfare state, but it was a warfare state. But as we saw in August, when it came to a crisis, this for the Georgians, very expensive military was, of course, completely inadequate to defend the country against Russia. So it was a huge waste of money, as well as a system whereby the government had this patronage coming from this Western money to fund its military build-up that was providing it with the capacity to pay for soldiers and police to protect the government against the population. Because the other side of the situation in Georgia what happened in November of 2007. There were big protests in the streets, large crowds complaining about corruption, complaining about the clan of the Saakashvili family running so much of the economy and the state apparatus. And these crowds were dispersed very brutally by very well-equipped police forces, some of the most sophisticated equipment for crowd dispersal, such as very low-frequency sources that make people feel very sickly if they don't have the right protection, and so on, plus standard riot gear like tear gas, and so on, coming from Western countries, paid for, oddly enough, by European Union countries like my own, and also by George Soros. George Soros used to boast that he was putting a lot of money into the Georgian police. And it's odd to think of the man who promotes the open society is always demanding that demonstrators should be listened to, that he's always criticizing governments that break up demonstrations, to find that, in fact, he had been one of the key figures in funding and helping to train this new powerful police force that broke up the opposition in November of 2007. Whereas back in 2003, the police seem to have been paid off to change sides from Shevardnadze to Saakashvili. So, putting it all in a nutshell, we've had really Western support for a regime, or two regimes, which are very similar over the last 16, 17 years, which actually I don't think live up to what we would think of as classic Western standards, either in economy or in democracy. And because it suited us, our governments, for geopolitical reasons, we've had a kind of media campaign, a lot of money spent on the media, to drown out any voices of criticism. And sadly, Georgia is the most acute case of this problem, but it's not by no means alone. It's a fairly routine problem, I'm afraid, across much of the world.
And of course, we were also told that Russia was responsible for starting the war, that it was Russia's vicious occupation of South Ossetia and Abkhazia that led the heroic Shakashvili to try to liberate these areas.
It's a complicated story, but I think that standard interpretation that you've just quoted is really put things almost on their head. The actual situation that arose back in 1992 was that you have a problem across the old Soviet Union, that you had a Soviet empire which people didn't necessarily want to live in, but then you have smaller states that are set up that have also their own minorities that don't necessarily want to live in the states that they've been given to. And we've had this strange situation where Stalin drew up the boundaries internally of the Soviet Union. He divided it up into the 15 republics. And we in the West have said the Soviet Union can break up, but these 15 republics that Stalin drew the boundaries of are sacrosanct. They are somehow the natural units. In fact, they were as arbitrary as most of what Stalin did. And sadly, in many places, Georgia particularly, you have the situation that Stalin included in the territory of, in this case, the Georgian Republic, people who, if you ask them, would not have wanted to be there. And back in 1992-93, there were already wars which the Georgians lost because the Shevardnadze's regime was good at being brutal to people who couldn't fight back. But they discovered the South Ossetians and the Abkhazians, partly because they got help from Russia, it's true, could fight back and defend themselves. And the situation was more or less frozen. Now, in many ways, there were lots of injustices on both sides. Ossetians and the Abkhazians remember horrible things the Georgians did to them. Georgian refugees, of course, will say, well, we've had to flee from our homes because we were frightened of the Ossetians and the Abkhazians. But over 15 years, you get a situation where getting people growing up, going through school and coming out of school without having lived under Georgian rule. And yet we in the West are sort of saying this is a kind of natural right to the Georgians to restore their authority. And at the same time, we're funding Saakashvili to build up his army and more or less encouraging him to do this, although I don't think specifically on the night of the 7th of August, I'm not sure that it was what the US government or the Europeans wanted, but they had, in a sense, set up this situation. And if we think of what actually happened in this crisis, there's a situation which for the Georgians is unsatisfactory. Two bits of their territory don't recognize their authority. But actually, since 1993, the Russians had provided a few thousand peacekeepers to divide the two sides, and it wasn't a perfect situation, but it prevented the kind of brutal fighting that we saw back at the beginning of the 90s. And if you are the Georgian government and you decide to send your troops through the Russian peacekeepers, well, what do you expect is going to happen? The Russians are going to get in the way and get killed. 12 to 15 of them were killed. If you remember back in Panama in 1989, one American serviceman was killed, and the first President Bush thought that was a justification for asserting, the U.S. right to intervene to stop it and to punish the government that had caused that. So the Russians had some precedent for saying that peacekeepers were there with the UN mandate. They'd been accepted by the Americans and the Europeans and originally. Now we wanted them to go, but we didn't have a mechanism for getting rid of them by force. Saakashvili sent his army into the area. It apparently very quickly overran the area because of the Russians only equipped with light arms and rifles and machine guns. But of course, Russia is right next door. So even as Saakashvili was celebrating his liberation, as he called it, of South Ossetia, the Russian troops from the North Caucasus, from the area of Chechnya, where of course there was a big Russian force, crossed into Georgia. I'm afraid all the Georgian training by the US military had not taught them most basic things like blowing up the bridges, and particularly the entrance to a road tunnel leading into Russia, so that they made huge blunders. Just as a kind of parenthesis here, I would say I was once talking to a US soldier who was involved in training Georgian troops. And he told me about how the corruption that was endemic in Georgia affected this process too. So that Georgian soldiers were paid $30 a day to take part in the training on sophisticated equipment. $30 a day, of course, is a lot of money for Georgians. But the problem this US soldier told me was that on day one, he would have Ramaz at hand and he'd be training him how to set up some sophisticated anti-missile system. On day two, Ramaz's brother, Emil, comes and he gets his $30. So you have to start all over again. And on day three, somebody's cousin arrives. And so you have a situation where the Georgians are apparently going to meet NATO standards, but their idea of how to meet NATO standards is very different, perhaps, from what you'd find in Canada or whatever. And so a lot of this money was wasted on training of various people who were never fully trained, organizing an army that turned out never to be fully organized, but which, in the eyes of President Saakashvili, had become a NATO-style powerful force that could just romp into South Ossetia and take the place over. So it seemed to happen. But then, of course, the Russians struck back. And I think he was surprised by this for two reasons. First of all, Russia had actually withdrawn its soldiers from the rest of Georgia in the previous 3 years. We often hear Putin attacked for being a Russian imperialist and trying to revive the Soviet Union. Well, maybe, but in the case of Georgia, he and his foreign minister, for instance, helped to get rid of Shevardnadze in 2003. They encouraged him to resign. They then withdrew the Russian troops from the bases in places like Batumi, where they had been in the south of Georgia for many, many years. And so perhaps Saakashvili thought they were on, but they would just retreat this time too, even if a few of them were killed, which was, I think, a huge problem for the Russians in any case to allow that to happen. But also, I know that he was in Madrid the day before the fighting broke out at a conference, and he apparently said to the Swedish Foreign Minister, Carl Bildt, that there was no point in trying to talk to the Russian president or to Putin because they were both going to be on the aeroplane going to the Beijing Olympics opening ceremony. So he clearly thought that the Russian political establishment would be paralyzed by being in flight somewhere over Siberia on their way to Beijing, and so his attack would take place whilst there would be nobody in charge of the Kremlin. Turned out this was a mistake because, in fact, only Putin was on the plane going to Beijing. President Medvedev was actually sitting in his office able to issue the orders for the Russian army to counterattack. So it seems that Saakashvili misjudged the Russian command system. He misjudged his own military capability and has produced, I'm afraid, a disaster for his country, which I suspect will lead to further political problems in the next few weeks.
Mark, also the U.S. is very active in Ukraine and other former republics of the Soviet Union. Is George Soros today spending his money and doing his interesting organizing in other places besides Georgia?
Yes, yeah. Across really the whole of the old Soviet Union, the old Soviet bloc, also in places in like Thailand and so on, he's very active. And he's very active in two levels. Despite his claims that he doesn't mix business with his foundations promoting a so-called open society, in fact, from Thailand through Georgia through Russia, he has had and has business interests. And of course, his business interests are greatly helped or hindered by who is in power. A lot of these non-governmental organizations that he promotes, so-called NGOs, A, have a political agenda that isn't just about educating voters or helping people to find out how to fill in the right forms to get their vote. It's actually about getting them to vote for the right candidates and, if necessary, inventing voters for the right candidates. Because a lot of his activists on the ground are as much part of the problem of voter fraud as they are supposed to be trying to educate old Soviet people into the new ways modelled on our own elections. I don't know what you think about US elections, but I know British elections have a lot of flaws. And in some ways, the intervention of Soros and his friends in our own political politics, both in America and in Britain, is making our elections less representative of what the voters really want, and more a game of who is the most effective organizer of voter registration, and in fact often of invented registrations. And I've seen this myself in Ukraine, for instance, and other places, where the Soros people make huge claims of cheating by the side they don't like. But actually, and they attract a lot of attention to the Western media that always looks in the direction that the Soros people are shouting about and say, look at this, look at that. But it's rather like the old story of the pickpocket in a crowded railway station or bus station who shouts, stop thief, whilst everybody's looking at where he's at the direction he's shouting at, he's slipping his hand into your back pocket and taking out your wallet. And in Ukraine, for instance, in 2004, all the Soros people were shouting about cheating in the east of Ukraine, but in the west of Ukraine, which was a stronghold of their so-called Orange Revolutionary Movement, same things they claimed were going on in the east, I saw for myself in the west. Ballot stuffing, destruction of votes for the wrong candidate, the person who's not supposed to win, and so on. Huge, apparently huge turnouts and votes of 90% plus for the candidate that Soros, and for that matter George Bush, wanted, because there's a strange situation that domestically, Soros may become known as one of the great critics of George W. Bush, but abroad, he very often acted in concert with George W. Bush's foreign policy, with Condoleezza Rice's policy, and so on, with the British government. And maybe now we're finding that some of these techniques that have been practiced abroad in places like Ukraine and Georgia are coming home to bite us, because also they want to be paid for by the taxpayer. Soros is very secretive. He says he promotes the open society. But you try finding out how his money is spent, who gets it. It's very, very difficult. He's one of the most non-transparent people in politics across the Northern Hemisphere. He funds a thing called Transparency International, which is always exposing fraud and corruption and the power of money on the part of other rich people or other institutions, but it never looks at the role of George Soros. You know, it's transparency for the rest of us, but not for him.
Mark, it must be a Soros-happy election coming up in the U.S. We've got Wall Street Candidate A and Wall Street Candidate B, although McCain seems to be more aggressive on the Georgian question and on the Ukrainian and related questions, but maybe Obama is playing a game. I don't know. Do you see Soros as active in the U.S. elections?
Well, I think perhaps Obama just realizes that for American voters, the domestic economy is the big question, and also the very active foreign policy of George W. Bush has disillusioned a lot of people. But if we look at his team, Obama has people who are very much involved with that policy. He's got Brzezinski, and if you like, the whole Brzezinski clan advising him. They are key figures in the promotion of Saakashvili in Georgia, of Yushchenko in Ukraine, so-called Orange Revolution. So Senator McCain may have been more forthright and vocal on these issues personally, but I think if we look at the people who surround Obama, there isn't really a big likely policy difference. And so it may well be that from the point of view of people like George Soros and others, it would be better to have a change of party in power in the States and have very much, you know, a new candidate who will be able to play to these very themes that people like Saakashvili have been presented as playing to in Georgia and so on. That is to say, they're new, they're untainted by the past, they offer us a bright new future, they are committed to the ideals that we all share of freedom, democracy, the market economy, and so on. And in some ways, it seems to me that Obama is an American version of that kind of, if you like, jack-in-a-box candidate who suddenly shoots up from nowhere, has a lot of money to present a very powerful and plausible case, makes powerful criticisms of the existing system, but at the same time isn't really going to fundamentally change it.
Dr. Mark Almond, thanks so much for talking with us this morning. And I think now we all know why you're one of the leading experts in the whole world on the Caucasus, on George Soros, on all that is happening in that part of the world. And thanks so much for coming on from Turkey to be on the show today.
Well, thank you very much for all your interesting questions. Thanks again.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@LouRockwell.com. And thanks for listening.